But I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. What a group. I want to thank you all for having me here. I'm so happy to be. Where am I, bud? It's Victor. Victor something. It's Victorville. I knew that. This is the second time I've been to Victorville. The first time, well, almost came. last year, my brother and my darling sister-in-law and my little darling niece, Gigi, came. We met up at Joshua Tree, and at some point, my brother was looking through the things to do map, and we saw this thing that said the biggest rock in the world was somewhere nearby. And in Landers, I think it is. It's the biggest rock in the world. And for some reason, my sister-in-law and Gigi didn't want to go, but my brother and I really wanted to go see the biggest rock. So we drove out to Landers, and we drove by the Orgasmatron, or something it's called. This guy has some goofy guy. Built a, shouldn't say he's goofy. I don't know if he was goofy or not, but it sure looked really screwy. But he had this thing out there in the middle of the desert, and it was something rearrange your DNA for you while the space people came. And it's closed now, but we got to see that. And then we drove out to the biggest rock. And there it was, by God. Great big old honking rock there. So after the thrill died down, we thought, what else could we do? You know, what we could do? My brother is my best friend. He was a really dear friend of mine. He's my brother, but he's like my dear friend too. And we're kind of wired the same, having the same kind of goofy DNA from my parents. I shouldn't say they were goofy, but it was pretty good. They're goofy. And so, especially for my dad, this part is really, so we thought we saw this name Victorville, and it just looked so victorious, you know, that we should go up there and see the victors. But but it was getting late, and we had to get back. And so we took some pictures of us by the rock. Big sign said Jesus Saves right on the biggest, could be right over the rock. And we went back to Joshua Tree, and my brother's sober too. He came in about 3 or 4 years after I did, and that's a great gift. And then his wife came in, and then the dog. The dog came in. Everybody's sober. We're just so thrilled. How long am I supposed to speak for? How long do I speak for? Okay, there you go. So I'm just going to start off here. I'm going to go off on the waters of and do as I've been taught to do, which is what it was like, what happened, and what's going on now. I was born, I'm not from West Hollywood. I don't know anybody in the world who's from West Hollywood. I live there now, and I'm so grateful to be here for the weekend. I was born in San Francisco. I was born and raised there. I'm really from San Francisco. And I'm a North Beach girl, and then my family moved down the peninsula for a while, and I went to school down the peninsula, and my father was born in 1899, and last year, if he were with us, he would have been 100 years old. So he was a way old guy. And my mother was about 21 and a half or 2 years younger than he. So they met in Palm Springs when she was about 17 and he was close to 40. So we're off to a real healthy start right there. Yeah, but what are you going to do? So they were, I don't know, they're very dear. I don't know. I'm going to talk a little bit about them because they're very much a part of my story. What are you going to do? My mother was a very, very beautiful girl. She was very beautiful. And my dad was a Creole, so always Spanish and French from New Orleans. And so he swears that he remembered the birth of jazz, you know. He'd tell me about growing up in New Orleans and playing ball in the streets with kids named Cassius and Brutus and Aurelius and, you know, and the Boudreaux and the, you know, the Beausoleils and the Gottschalks and all his friends, you know. And he said he remembered watching the funeral cortege, what do you say, going to... Hi there, Tom. Mr. Pronounce that word. The cortege, thank you. You follow those, and they'd be playing jazz. You know, they'd be doing the beginnings of sort of the improvisation, you know, that went on to become known as our great American music, you know, jazz and blues. And he'd tell me stories about the Mardi Gras and how they would go pick up the girls and the coaches with the, you know, with the four horses, and they'd be wearing masks, and oh God, all these great stories. And my mom, of course, was from San Francisco. It was a great town too. And she was raised, her father was the commodore of the yacht club, you know. She was raised on an 87-foot gaff rig schooner called the Eloise. And there was a ballroom on this boat. And when she was a little girl, she'd roller skate on the ballroom of the ship, the yacht. And they started the Transpac race. My grandfather was a great sailor and a great alcoholic. I come from a great line of really renowned alkies. he was busted for coming back from Hawaii with a hole full of booze during Prohibition. And they have a picture of and everything in the newspaper and, you know, the story about busting him for the booze. And he said it was simply, you know, strictly for medicinal purposes. He owned the first automobile in San Francisco, my grandfather. My grandmother, I don't know why I'm talking about my family so much, but my grandmother was 43 or something when my mother was born. So they're all old people. They're really old. They go way back. So my grandfather had first car in San Francisco, and he went to get a license because he'd read that he needed one, and they didn't know what to do. They'd never issued a license for an automobile in San Francisco, so they said, come back in the morning. So he came back in the morning in the car, and they drove him up into Golden Gate Park on a bridle path, and he was driving, and at some point they threw out a dummy, and he slammed on the brakes, and he missed the dummy, and they gave him a license. That was the first driving test. It's amazing. Anyway, he was a big alky, and he's a wonderful guy, and there's a family that was kind of eccentric on both sides. And when I was growing up, there was a lot of partying going on. They were the yuppies of their day, I guess, the up and coming after World War II, and everybody was on a fast track, you know, and it was a little black cocktail dress and the pearls, and everybody was in a great mood and making a lot of money, I guess, and I think America was pretty much whacked out of its mind. Everybody was stoned, don't you think? You know, we look back with all those cocktail parties and stuff, it was running the engine there. And it was not unusual, I don't think, for everybody to be having a great time. Now, when I was a little girl, I'd watch everybody, and I wasn't having a very good time. I felt kind of left out. I wasn't a happy kid. I was having a hard time. My mom and I didn't bond too well when I was a little girl. She had a terrible time after the pregnancy, and we were separated. She had to go into a hospital for a long time. And so there was no bonding there. And, you know, I don't think we ever got off to a very good start. And I felt I was a different kid. I was an alcoholic kid. Now, I can remember I was very, very happy up until about the age of 7, 5, or 6. And because I had a lot of critters, we lived in the country, and I had down south in San Francisco, and I had my animals, and we had lots of animals. My father loved having animals, so we had ducks and chickens and rabbits and goat and you know, and sunflowers that grew up too high and zucchinis that were too big, and it was like Findhorn but loaded. And but I was a little off. I remember feeling very lonely, different than the other kids. I couldn't concentrate in class. You ever have that problem where you just couldn't keep your mind on what was going on? I just wanted to be outside. I didn't want to be in school. And my family was partying quite a bit. There were big parties going on all the time, and I'd be going off to this, you know, to kid work, you know, going to school, and they'd be having this great old time. Uncle Herbie would be wearing a sheet, and he'd have the plastic grapes from the center around his ears, you know, and he was bald. He looked just like Julius Caesar. And he'd be making a, you know, what do you think would be whirling around would be the morning drink, the hangover cure. They called it a governor's smile, like a Ramus or something. And that'd be going, and everybody'd be laughing, and people would be crawling around. And I thought, I can't wait to be like them. I have to go off to school, and I can't wait to grow up and start having some fun. This being a kid is hideous. I don't like it much, you know. I keep looking for a watch. I really don't want to talk too long, you know. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Ooh, this is not excellent. Good one. I like your program. When I look back now, I realize I had all the ism in place, you know. My father was a workaholic. He was a self-made guy, you know. He was very proud. He's Spanish Basque, you know, and my mother was beautiful but fragile. She was so fragile, we had to be very careful in the house not to upset my mother for any reason, so I was never naughty. I wasn't allowed to be naughty. Or express myself too much. It was a typical alcoholic home with violence. There was a lot of fighting, unhappiness. It was tough, you know. I don't know what we do with alcoholics raising children. It's just such a mess. I've never had any myself, but I've ruined a couple of dogs. And I, you know, it's hard to make an amends to a dog, you know, it just, but they accept it so gracefully. So anyway, and, you know, by, and also, you know, I was being a girl child, you know, girl children are up for grabs, you know, in our society. It's terrible. The boys experience it too. I think our children are just not as protected as, or we, maybe they never have been. You know, and we're talking about it more now, but I was molested as a little girl by a man who worked for our family, and he was around, and to me was like another father. And so about the age of 9, I was a done deal. I knew that God had abandoned me. I couldn't understand why. I had assumed that it was because I had hurt my mother so badly being born. You know how children have to come up with some kind of understanding of the checks and balances of life. And that worldview, I needed some way to understand what the universe was about. So I just chose to believe it was my fault. It's something I had done, had created the chaos and the pain in my little life. And in my parents' life, that maybe if I had been a better little girl, my parents wouldn't fight so much or whatever, you know. And I think so many the alcoholics, you know, when I listen in meetings and I hear things, there's so much that happened before we started drinking that had been so important to the reason that we maybe picked up. Not that I think that my parents have anything to do with my alcoholism. I really know that I sort of was born with the disease. I think it's a genetic predisposition, and plus I had the mindset from the word go. Also, I was whacked out of my head on sugar as a child. Once I found sugar, that was it. I was, you know, face down in the Haagen-Dazs as a child, and the cookies and everything else I could get my hands on, because it was like medication. I would have the cornflakes and this much sugar in the bottom of the bowl. I know you relate to that. A lot of people do. And so my system is like one of those hair-triggered little systems that just was ready for the kerosene, you know, and the match. And so by the time I was 12, I was really needed to drink. And that's when I needed one bad, you know. And Ricky and Jill, my two little buddies and I, went down to the to Burlingame, where I lived, and we stole a bottle of Brown Derby beer, which is a big bottle of beer with a twist top. I know. And we stole this big bottle, and the three of us sat around and got loaded. And it was the most fun in the world. Now, Rick went on to become a really magnificent educator, and he's a renowned sort of architectural historian and writes, you know, wonderful articles for magazines. And Jill went on to become also an educator, and she has a big ranch up in Northern California, and she teaches and she writes about teaching. And I went on to become, you know, Miss Alcafon 1983. You know, they had as much fun as I did, but they stopped. And I continued. I started at 12, and I didn't end until I got here, you know. So at any rate, but what happened when I drank was the amazing magic of alcohol. It was just like the plasma I'd been waiting for. All my inhibitions dropped away. I became extremely funny. Jill wet her pants laughing at me in the smoke shop. You know, she never got over it. And I was, you know, all of a sudden I was somebody else. I was me, but better. I was a better me. I was a different me, and a me I liked better. And once I had that trick in my bag, you know, once I knew that alcohol was there, it wasn't that I became a daily drinker at 12, far from, but there was an extraordinary sense of relief and knowing that I had this ally, this thing that I would be able to rely on. Now, when we got home that night, we were all pretty tipsy, you know, and Jill's parents were horrified. And they grounded her for, I think, the next 15 years. We're waiting for her to be able to go out on a Saturday night. And Rick's parents were horrified. They absolutely were horrified. And my mother sat down and poured herself a drink, and we bonded. You know, we had like a little heart-to-heart, and it was fantastic. I was kind of off to the races. I was a real isolator. By the age of about 12, and then I also found something that was very important for my life, which was music. My father had come from a musical family, and although you'd never know it, because he couldn't carry a note in a bucket. If this guy started to sing, we would have to go to church with him sometimes. It was just terrifying, because he'd start to sing, and people would duck their heads and go to the pew, like, none of the Christian soldiers, you know, it was just so awful. But he was from a musical family, and my mother's family were artists and painters, and so they were pretty very interesting people, really. But I found music on my own at about 12. I started to play guitar, and the weirdest thing happened. I became a blues singer. Now, I don't know how this happened. My father couldn't understand it, but we used to listen to opera together. He'd play opera for me, and the poor man was trying to educate me and give me a beautifully cultured background. But I love the blues, and that was just too bad, you know. I'm just an alky girl who loves the blues, you know, poor guy. And so before you knew it, I was joining rock bands and stuff and playing up in San Francisco, and just horrible things were going on. I went away to school for a while, and they asked me to come back, and because I was flunking. And he wrote me the darlingest letter. He said, please come back. You're so far away. Come home and flunk nearby. But once I'd left home at that young age, you know, I was gone. You know, when you send your kids away to school, that's it. They're gone. You know, that's what happened for me. And so I was gone. So by the time I got back, I was a different kind of gal. I was a little beatnik, you know, and I was a little bohemian, and I was feeling more and more alienated, because what was happening was the alcohol that I was using, it was occasional. I wasn't an everyday drinker, but I was so vulnerable inside. I felt so vulnerable and scared and without any kind of roadmap. And alcohol made me feel strong. It made me feel courageous and brave. And I started to build this persona. You know, it was like having a marionette that would be in front of you, but the real you was way back here, trying to watch, trying to figure out what to do next, trying to figure out what the right move might be. And the alcohol sort of fueled this fake person. And as the years went by, I got further and further away from my own soul, from the connection within, which is an integrated person. I think especially around that early adolescent time, which seems to be the disease time for us. When I listen to a lot of alcoholics, they all started drinking in their early teens. Most of us started real young, you know, our early teens. And that's, about the age when you start to find, you individuate, the word is, I think, where you start, you know, in most societies, there's a, most cultures have a moment where they honor their young women and they honor their young boys, young men, as they come into that prepubescent time and they start to go into an adult mode, sort of, you know, and they try and direct you a little bit. And if with any luck at all, you have a little bit of a background, a foundation underneath you, you can make that transition, because we know that hormonal mishigas is really a lot to, you know, maneuver through. You need all the help you can get. And I think I found that my help in alcohol. So rather than individuate and make that transition, I refused to go through that transition. And I found alcohol instead. When everybody else was going through puberty, I was going, go ahead, you guys. You go on without me, you know. I mean, just, you know, all the stuff that the girls were trying, you know, they're plucking their eyebrows. It just felt like torture to me. And getting into a pair of pantyhose is like, you know, getting into a slingshot, for God's sake. You know, I just like, I don't know. I was just scared to death of the whole thing. Go on without me, I'll be fine. You're young, you have a life, you know, I'm going to just sit here and drink, you know. And that's what I did. But I became a parody of myself, and over the years, you know, the music was so important to me. And that always stayed important. But I couldn't husband my talent. You know, I couldn't take care of what had been given me to do. I'm as much an artist and a musician as I am an alcoholic, you know. I was sort of born with that thing going on inside. And that was very important for me, to be able to express that and to be a good artist. And I hope to be a great artist one day. And to watch all of that going, falling from you. And it's as though you can't hold on to it. You had dreams and you had visions for your life and you had hopes and expectations and great desire. And you're watching it all go away. And there's nothing you can do. You just have to keep drinking and watch it, you know, leaving your grasp. You can never hold on to it at all. And it's a terrible way to live. It's after a while, I felt like I was becoming a phantom, like a ghost. I lived in the dark side of life, and in the world of the night. That's where I felt comfortable. I felt comfortable in the dark. And I love those old bar rooms, you know. I left home the day I graduated from high school. My father kind of gave me an ultimatum. He said, the house isn't big enough for both of us. Now, I think I'd smoked some weed. I think I smoked some grass. I wasn't a bad kid, but my dad was 100 years old last year. You know, he was from another world. When my brother got busted for planting the whole backyard, was you know, a gentleman farmer back there. He was like raising crops of it, you know, and they had a gentlemanly handshake while they decided to, you know, burn it. So within, you know, just 5 years between me and my brother, you know, my father learned how to kind of roll with it. But with me, I'm the first one. And, you know, the first kid always turns out a little, like the first pancake is always a little wonky. You know? I don't know what the heck they're doing, you know. You can't blame them. So he said the house wasn't big enough for both of us, and so there I was. And I hope I get sober here, because, you know, it's going to be third grade and I'm 40 minutes into it. So there I was, you know, out on my own. I'm 17 years old. I mean, just 17. I'm a little virgin. I'm trying to look like a slick, hip, and cool. And I'm running around in North Beach. I moved back up to San Francisco, and I'm singing in rock bands, and we have recording contracts and stuff, and none of it comes through. And I start to drink because I have to make a living, and the only thing I know how to do is sing, you know, and play. So I have this kind of experience. I'm in these rooms with people much older than me. I'm trying to pass myself off as an older person. Now I'm trying to pass myself off as a younger person. Funny how that works. Back and forth. But and there I am with my guitar singing, and people are coming up, and A&R people from the Los Angeles, and I'm getting recording contracts, and it's all so very exciting, and I've got managers and people, and they want to, I'm going to be the next big something or other. and I'm scared to death. I don't even know how to describe how terrified I am inside. And I don't know how to do this thing that they think that I do. I don't even know how I do it, you know. So I'm just drinking, and finally this big A&R guy comes up from Capitol Records, and they got the everything. It's going to be, everything's coming up, process. It's going to be great. And I get drunk. And I bring up all my friends and say, you gotta hire them too or I'm not coming, you son of a bitch. And I bring up some, you know, like banjo picker from, you know, Petaluma that has to come with me or else I'm not going. How attractive, you know. And for some reason they passed on me and I used this to validate my terribly low opinion of myself. I said, see, I'll never be anything. I'm born to lose. I'm dark and destructive and evil, and there's something very bad about me. You know, I had this terrible sense. And you know, when I look back and I remember who I was and how I was, I was such a beautiful young girl. I was only 18 years old. Someday, I wish, you know, I could go back now and get her. Do you know what I mean? I think about her and how sweet she really was, and absolutely without a clue as to how vicious the world could be. And I learned very fast how vicious the world can be. You know, nobody's out looking out for a little 17, 18-year-old girl who's, you know, crocked out of her brain. You know, I don't know how I survived myself, really. And I wound up in the mental hospital and jail and the whole skidoo. I'm really a real alky. I did drugs and everything, but I didn't like them too much. I wasn't a great pot smoker. The minute I started smoking pot, I'd hear voices and stuff, and I'd start to hallucinate. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure that pot smokers would love what was happening to me, but I didn't love what was happening to me, so I would have to drink a lot, you know. And I wasn't great with, I love speed. Now I take it back. I loved speed. That was a good drug because you could drink more. And I really loved cocaine. Cocaine was very, very nice indeed. That got me here real fast. Once the cocaine came in, thank God, you know, it probably took a good 5 years off my, you know, time I would have because it rushed me in. So that was a good drug. And of course the lovely people that come attached to cocaine. You know how adorable those people are, how sweet and kind and like, you know, those are the ones. So I think maybe I should segue to my bottom. I want to say that I drank my way across a couple of continents. I was 86 from Holland. I had left Holland for a while and was trying to get back, and they said, no, we know about you. So I wasn't allowed back into Holland. So that's kind of an interesting thing to happen to. I lived all over Europe for about 6 years. I traveled, and I had this wonderful boyfriend named James, and he wrote softcore pornography for a living. And he was a sweet guy. And we traveled around Morocco and Spain and all over Europe, and I'd pull out my guitar and sing. We'd make new friends, and we had a really rather remarkable time. And then I came back to New York. A wonderful singer-songwriter suggested that I come to New York because he had a great opportunity for me, and it was with one of the great producers of all time. And I had an audition with this guy, and I was living at the Chelsea Hotel in New York and playing at Max's Kansas City and making some good reviews, and all of a sudden I went to see this guy and I couldn't stop shaking. I had tried to stop drinking before I saw him, and so I was sweating and shaking and I could hardly function. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you're a very talented person. He said, I've listened to your work. He said, you're really very talented. He said, but I couldn't really invest my company's money in you right now, the shape you're in. God help me. And I slunked out of there and did some very serious drinking. And somebody, and in New York you can kill yourself because the bars are open all night long. You go, they're open till 4, and then you can go down to the Fulton Fish Market and make friends with the fisher folk and drink down there. And that's what I did. And I was almost dead, and a friend looked at me and said, you know, you got to get back home. So I came back to San Francisco, and I moved to a place called Half Moon Bay. I'm getting toward my bottom now because I can't stand being drunk like this anymore. Yuck. Anyway, And I got into this. I got all sorts of things, and I needed work, and so I got this job, and I went from having this wonderful, you know, education in Europe and wonderful opportunities, and there I was. My new job was I was a sea urchin roe processor out on a barge in the Princeton Harbor, and the boys would pick me up in a little double-ender fishing boat. We'd go on out there to the middle of the barge, and my job was to separate the sea urchin guts, you know, to separate the viscera from the roe. And it's a wonderful career move for any of you women out there who's thinking about doing something that's lovely for your hands. And so all day long, they'd be throwing up these sea urchins, and we'd crack them open, and I'd scoop this, you know. And I worked for these two Japanese guys, because we'd send the sea urchins off to Japan. One guy was named Tacky, and we called the other guy Wacky, just to, you know, for the balance. And they'd bring out a bunch of rice balls and all the beer we could drink. We were just so happy. And at the end of the day, I'd have my waders on and my hat, you know, and I'd go into the Miramar, you know, covered from head to toe in sea urchin guts, which apparently is an aphrodisiac for some guys. I don't know what it is. And I'd walk into the Miramar, and there'd be some guy sitting there, you know, my guy. I would never have met him before, but I knew he was my guy, because he'd be sitting there at the end of the bar, you know, fuck up, you know, and he'd have like an albatross on one shoulder and a rain cloud over the top of him coming down, and I'd look at him, and I'd just recognize that was my guy, you know. And so I had this urge to make love to people that no one else would touch with a 10-foot pole. I'm not sure what that was about. Just this sweet kind of friendly aspect of my being. That was my job. I don't know. So it went on like that until finally I moved back to San Francisco, and I knew that I was in big trouble. And it was right about that time, around the sea urchin time, that I started to know that I was in very bad trouble. My car looked like an accordion. And I was driving like this all the time. I was completely blacked out. I would be in blackouts for days at a time. I'd wake up I woke up in Montana once, you know, on an Indian reservation with wonderful new friends. But I don't know how I got there. I don't know what I was doing there. I would be in blackouts for days. And I was terrified that I was going to hurt somebody. And I also could see that my family was in great pain over me. And I was, you know, I wasn't able to connect anywhere. So I decided to stop drinking, and I did. I stopped drinking for 9 months, and I joined an alternative. I went to my first AA meeting, and I never hated anything worse in my life. I went into that AA meeting, and there was some guy in a three-piece suit, a little gal, you know, big old heavy gal with a spoolie or something hanging in. And I thought, what in God's name am I doing here? I never wanted to drink so bad as I did that AA meeting, and I just tore out of there and wound up staying sober on my own for about 9 months. And then after 9 months, I thought, you know what, I can have a little wine with dinner, and I can drink like a lady now because my system is cleaned out, and certainly I can do that. And so I did. I had a little wine, and I drank beautifully, I think, for about 20 minutes. And it was just like, same, man. I was just done. And it was another 5 years of just incomprehensible demoralization. I finally woke up in San Francisco. I was living on 24th Street with a guy named Rolando. I call him El Sico de Mayo, and because he was an unattractive, very unattractive example of our disease. I pray for him once in a while. I was working in a delicatessen and stealing a little money from them, and I was working for minimum wage, and I was stealing from the delicatessen because Roland Elsego was too sensitive to work. And so I had to, you know, augment everything. And so I'd be stealing food and walking out with ham hocks. And good night, everybody. And finally, one morning, about 3 in the morning, I looked in the mirror, and I saw my reflection. I could not recognize myself. My face was very puffy. I was still a young woman. I had lost everything. Every opportunity had come to me. I had screwed up. I knew it wasn't my parents. I knew it wasn't Rolando. I knew it was me. I knew it was me. And I looked in that mirror, and I looked in my own eyes, and I said, God help me. And I don't remember ever saying anything even remotely like that. I had always thought of myself as somewhat of a mystic and a strange sort of spiritually inclined person, but most of my prayers and most of my conscious contact was reserved, you know, for moments at 3 or 4 in the morning when I had a fist raised, no matter what you think you're doing, stuff, and screaming and everything else. And this was a very different moment. And I think that moment of such deep sincerity and clarity, and I don't hear about that much anymore, that moment of clarity, but I felt as though a clarion blast must have gone off because something heard me. Something heard me. And it was as though some kind of spiritual thermal lifted me up. And through the agency of a couple of phone calls, that night I was in my second AA meeting 5 years later. It was the big Tuesday night downtown meeting in San Francisco, and I was there all of a sudden. I don't even know, it was as though some door opened, like the gates of hell flew open, and all of a sudden I was sitting in a completely different atmosphere. The Tuesday downtown meeting, hundreds of people, and they were from all over, you know, it's like the big basin meeting for all the little tributary neighborhood meetings. San Francisco's a wonderful city. If you go up there, you feel like it's your mother, you know, you never call it Frisco if you're from San Francisco. You call it San Francisco. She's your mom. It's the most beautiful city, and it has wonderful neighborhoods, and each neighborhood is very, very different from the other neighborhoods. And so the big basin meeting and the big Tuesday downtown meeting brought in people from all over the city. And there we were in this AA meeting, all of humanity just spread out. Every race, every color, every religion, every sex, you know, because it's San Francisco. And just every kind of human being. And I wasn't used to that. I had been living my life, had just been restricted now to just a couple of blocks. I had been 86 from all the bars. You know how hard it is for a woman to get 86 from the bars? You know, like the longshoreman bars and stuff. You know how hard it is to do that? They really are dying for you to come in there. And anyway, so all of a sudden there was this wonderful world, and it was so clear, the atmosphere in there, like it is in here, you know. It was clean and clear, and there was something so fresh and good about it. You know, I'm from Northern California, and I spent a lot of time in the Redwoods, and after it rains in the Redwoods, there's a kind of, and the sun comes out, there's a kind of an ozone smell. I don't know, it's like deep oxygen smell that just comes up from the ferns in the bottom of the forest. And it's like being in a cathedral, you know, and that smell, that cleanliness, that feeling was really the way I remember that Tuesday downtown meeting. Something so clean about it. And they asked if there were any newcomers, and I was with this woman, and she could see I was, and she poked me and said, raise your hand. And so there I just very gingerly started to raise my hand and say, hello, my name is Teresa, and I'm an owl. And then the word owl, you know, just came up from the center of the earth, just started working through my body up and out. It was like I coughed up the biggest hairball that ever was, you know. And there I was, you know. I knew that the war was over, and I had been fighting such a war. I had been insisting on my right to drink. I needed that drink. Don't you know I needed that drink? I had become so far from my own soul and so far from my own heart that I really needed a drink to be able to stand what I had become. You know, I had to justify my being, and the only way I could exist on the planet was to keep drinking. Because I was so ashamed and so hurt and so blasted out, you know, routed out from the innards. And to give up alcohol and to not know where I was going next, you know how brave it is, our little newcomers and our dear newcomers who come in, how brave that moment, that first moment to say I'm an alcoholic, how brave we all were to do that. And all we had was the smiles, you know, of strangers around us. You know, just a room full of strangers. And that was April 17th, 1983. So I haven't had to have any kind of anything since then. I've tried, you know. What's one of the things I've tried to do is my obsession, my obsessive nature has not, you know, it didn't just stop with the alcohol. We have a game up in at the Fun House when I was a kid called Whack-A-Mole. You ever seen that thing? It's got like 9 holes and a mole will put its head up. You have a mallet, you know, and you can whack it like, and it comes up and whack it there, and it comes over here, whack over here, whack over here. And that's what sobriety's been like for me. I mean, it's been one compulsion after another. You know, it's like, oh, there's a cigarette, whack, you know, there's a career, whack, you know, now it's him, whack. And then, you know, and then if you make a good score, you know, you get another free game of whack-a-mole, you know. You know, all these little delirious children and from the whack-a-mole. But that's what it's been like, you know. Then the cigarettes, I had to put the cigarettes down, and then my second year of sobriety, I, you know, ballooned up because I was, you know, I would eat a doorknob if it were dipped in chocolate, I found out. And I had no idea that that was a problem. And then it was drinking coffee out of a bucket, and that had to go. And then it was my career. No, shit. You know. And then it was the man, and it was, you know, Christ. So, you know, everything has to go because I think what's called upon here is sort of a, because it, after a while, of course, as you know, it doesn't work. Nothing works. And we don't want to tell the newcomers any of that because you know, you don't want to tell them the truth yet. Like, yes, all your dreams will come true. Oh, yes, I drive a big car. And I really was hoping for all that stuff, you know. In my third year, well, let me just get to some stuff here. I hope I'm not overdoing it here. I'm going to get to it. All right. So, so at that very first meeting, I met a guy named Frank. And Frank has been sober 55 years now, I think. And he's very well known in San Francisco. He was an old curmudgeon-y looking guy to me. And he didn't have his teeth in or anything. And he was wearing a funny little suit and a little watch cap. And I thought he was there for the cookies, you know. And but it turns out like he's this bodhisattva kind of wonderful man who spent his whole life in service. And he was cleaned up the waterfront. And he got the first, you know, recovery homes in San Francisco going. And he's a really well-known, loved person. And he came up to me, and he'd seen me raise my hand as a newcomer. And I was anorexic. I probably weighed about 105 pounds, you know, and which is, I'm 5'8", you know, so I was a little... And I was, you know, all that newcomer chic and all the big eyeliner and stuff and smoking cigarettes, you know. Fuck you. How attractive we can be. And so he came up to me and he said,
you're a very important person. He said, you got here just in time. You're going to save a lot of lives. You're going to help a lot of people. And it's a great thing you got here. But first of all, you need a commitment. You need to do something right away. Get plugged in so everybody can meet you and you can start helping people. He said, you need to be a greeter. It's the most important job in AA. You'll be standing there outside, and you'll be putting your hand out to those poor, shaky, scared alcoholics, and you'll be bringing them in. Lord God, that's important. You got to do it.
And so I'm looking at this guy, and I'm thinking, whoa, you know, I'm important. You know, I better get to work. And I'm going to save lives. And, you know, I mean, at that moment, I would have done anything for this guy. Anything at all. No one had ever spoken to me that way. They had told me I was important. I couldn't believe it. And I just thought, and I just wanted, whatever he said, this was amazing to me. So I signed up and I became a greeter. Second meeting, I'm a greeter, I think. And I'm out there shaking hands going, what the fuck am I doing here? Yeah. What's happening to me? You know, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I was. I'm shaking hands. I don't know what I'm doing. And but sure enough, within a couple of weeks, the whole world changed for me. I was now no longer with San Francisco, this this little couple of blocks, but everywhere I went, I would see alcoholics that I had met at the Tuesday Downtown meeting. The world became populated with alcoholics, fellow alcoholics. It was just unbelievable. Everywhere I went, I saw them everywhere. It was unbelievable. And the world became like this village, this happy village. Wherever I went, I would see people I had greeted at AA meeting. I caught on to Frank pretty quick, though, because I went to a meeting about 3 weeks into it, and there he was. He cornered some newcomer guy, and he said,
"You're a very important person. You got here just in time. You're going to save a lot of lives. It's very important. You get a commitment right away. You need to be the coffee maker. Most important job at an AA meeting is making the coffee to those poor, shaky alcoholics. They need their caffeine. You got it."
So then I went on to go to meetings, and I started to go to women's meetings. I went to a women's meeting on Sutter Street called the Brown Bag Bells. And these gals were something else, you know, with the beehives and the fingernails and, you know, doing their nails at the meetings and, you know, "What step are you working, honey? What step are you working?" And I'm still all in black, you know, I don't know anything. These women were just unbelievable. And they're, you know, and they're working and they're doing everything, and I'm just so shaky, and they were so sweet to me. And Wade was very sweet. There was an older man named Wade D. from Valentine, Nebraska. He went back there, but he was 33 years sober the year I came in, and he was such a perfect, sartorially beautifully, he was always beautifully dressed, and he had a cane, and he was just so elegant and lovely and kind to me. And I started to be reparented in AA. I started to have people who loved me, re-siblings, and became socialized in AA. And I started to feel, you know, it took me years to be able to identify what I was feeling. It took me about 2 years. I knew that I, 2 years to recognize that I was feeling. You know, I didn't know what I was feeling. And I was told I needed to do my fourth step. So at 9 months sober, I did my first fourth step. And I had this wonderful sponsor. Her name was Stephanie. And she was very lovely. She was a bit older than I was, and she made her living as a writer. And I had such respect for that. And she had this tiny little apartment right under Coit Tower. And she was very bohemian and really cool. And she ate with chopsticks. And she kept saying this word to me. She said, "Isn't it amazing," she said, "that how interesting AA is, and how mystical it really is, and that it's really this secret society, and you're looking for the Buddha, and you find two guys named Bob and Phil." You know, I think she's absolutely right. And I read up with my fourth step, and I remember my knees were shaking because Stephanie, I feel like the prize heifer or something like that. I won! Oh yeah, Rails, look at that. I don't know what a yellow ribbon stands for though. I don't know. Oh well, let's not think about it. So I went up there with my fourth step, and I was very nervous because I loved her. You know, I just thought the world of her, and I didn't want her not to like me. And I was so scared of what I was going to have to say in this fourth step, and I knew I had to be rigorous on this one, and I was just terrified. And I went up, and I shared my fourth step with her, and she, of course, did the good old AA thing and swapped me story for story, you know. And as I was about to leave, and I was standing at the top of the stair, and I looked at her, and she had this really weird look in her eyes. It was a kind of a goopy, guppy look in her eyes. And I thought, what's the matter with Stephanie? You know, I was looking, and I realized that she was looking at me with love. And it just hit me, like it just hit me. She loves me. And I don't know that it was that I got that she loved me, but I got that she loved. And I was feeling it. for really the first time in my life. I remember when my little brother was born, Arturo, and I remember when he was about two or three, and he was crawling around on the floor, and I remember my heart just filled with love for my little brother. Just like, ah. And all of a sudden, not since that time had I had that feeling. And when I looked at her, I knew something had cracked open in my heart. AA did for me what sort of, I think what does for us, what Frank did for me that night, is that it, AA remembers for us who we are. He would say, you know, come in, sit down, you've been out there in a nightmare, you've wreaked a lot of havoc, a lot of havoc's been wreaked on you, sit down, calm down, do these suggested little suggestions or these steps, work with others, etc., and gradually you'll start to come to. You'll wake up. You'll wake up from the terrible nightmare. You'll wake up from the bad dream, from the unreality of the life you led. And you will come into the reality of your true being here. And I think that journey is infinite. It keeps going on because the nature of the soul is so huge and it's all God. When Frank would stand there and look at me like that, and we're still very good friends. Frank's getting old now. I think he's about 80-something. And they just had his 55th birthday for him up there, and everybody went. But he's still really sharp, you know. And when I really need good advice, I give him a call, and he hones in on me just like, you know, Yoda. He just, so many years of working the principles and working with others and living in the fourth dimension has given him a great insight, huge insight. And one of the things I think about our discipline, about being AA people, is that we've been given a shortcut to the fourth dimension. I want to end on this. I want to talk a little bit about this because it's so fascinating to me. They said we'll be skyrocketed into the fourth dimension. Well, we've lived in the third dimension, and God knows as alcoholics, we really kicked the shit out of the third dimension. We didn't get so hot in there, you know. But one of the things that we find out about the 3D world is that, and the seemingly material world, we call it, is that it has nothing to offer us. There's nothing out there for us, and we know that because we're the ones who took it to the furthest you can take it. You know, we're the ones who couldn't get enough money, who couldn't get enough prestige, who couldn't get enough property, who couldn't get enough sex, who couldn't get enough sugar, who couldn't get enough alcohol, who couldn't get enough drugs. We had more than our share, and it never filled us, and it never made me happy. It never fulfilled me. It never brought me to fulfillment. It never once did I feel comfortable out there, no matter what I had, no matter what I didn't have. So we know that the three-dimensional world is not where the answer lay. It's in the fourth dimension. And what rules the third three-dimensional world is fear. And what rules the fourth is love. And everyone in the world is trying to get to the fourth dimension, I think. We're all on a spiritual path. People who don't know they're on a spiritual path are on a spiritual path, because to be human and to have a soul is to be of spirit, is to be of God. And we here are so lucky because we've tried everything. We know nothing works. We know only God works. And when you go in, you know, there's all these disciplines where they have you sit up on mountaintops or under waterfalls or banging tambourines in airports and stuff, and all the stuff that you know, are supposed to do to give them all your money and shave your head and, you know, barbecue the children or whatever it is that you're supposed to do. We have this wonderful shortcut into the fourth dimension, which is service. Service is the shortcut to God. We do it all the time here. Whenever I'm working with one of my sponsees, I go in and say, what would you have me say? Father, Mother, God, you know, all of a sudden I can feel myself being taken over. Moments of service when we're out of the way and we're just love channeled through. I got one last thing to say. I'm available for dating. No. That's very brave, I know. Well, as you say, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. That's what they are. I think I've spoken long enough. I just want to end with this. If you're new to AA, you're in for God love you. You know, I'm so glad that you're here. This is really the place to be. I don't think there's a more exciting path to be on. I don't think there's anything more exciting. I've been to meetings all over the place, and everywhere I go, there's just family to be met. Just beloved friends to be met. I've never not known it to be that way. Wherever I go in the world, I was the loneliest person I've ever known. I was so lonely. And I still get that way sometimes, don't you? I mean, we have the disease. I still sometimes wonder, come on, what's going on here? You know, sometimes I go through those dark nights of the soul, and I think, I don't know anything. I shouldn't be speaking. You know, we're going to have a group slip, you know. I'm thinking tonight, because I was depressed about something with my family, you know. I can't seem to get it to work with my mom, no matter what I do, you know. I have to give up, you know, and finally, after 17 years of sobriety, I finally hit bottom. I'm going to Al-Anon. You know, and I'm in Al-Anon now, you know. I'm so exhausted from recovering, I can't even tell you. But I'm finding a new love and a new freedom in that program, too. You know, it's just wonderful. It's just so wonderful. So from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for my life, and I hope to make something worthwhile of it. I don't have to worry about that. I just hope God makes something worthwhile of me, can use me, because that's the only thing that's ever brought me happiness, was the absolute faith and knowledge that God's will is being worked through me. Then I'm a happy camper. You know, I'm a very happy camper, and I know you are too. Thanks so much for listening.